The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed finally hikes rates. Markets end a messy week, mixed. Trump is targeting China. And our guest today, Brad Baldridge, of TamingTheHighCostOfCollege.com. All this and much more on episode number 489 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Just a few more days till Christmas, just a few more after that till the new year begins. We have Hanukkah and all sorts of great holidays this time of year, so I'm wishing you well. I'm wishing you a wonderful Christmas, which is just a week away, and Hanukkah falling on the same day this year. Andrew Horowitz here, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hopefully, like others who have written in, you like the new music, the new intros. We also have some new things happening over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you haven't visited there lately, I would encourage you to do so. We had a big design change, still working on some of the development for additional content and ideas and things to make sure that you stay in touch and involved and get the best information that's out there. But let's talk about some of the things that are happening in the markets, because it was a pretty big week. Finally, oh my gosh, we need bells, whistles, we need drum rolls and cymbals, symphonies. The Fed raised rates the first time in a year. And if you recall, I've been talking about this for some time, that I thought that, you know, it's quite possible that what they're going to end up doing is pretty much the game plan from last year. Things worked out pretty well. People didn't, you know, get panicked or spooked, aside for the first month or so as the dollar rose up. And the game plan looks almost identical, doesn't it? You know, we waited till December. The dollar has been rising up pretty dramatically. And last year, the one big difference was that maybe they said, as they're behind their closed doors, the Fed's talking about, all right, what should we do? Well, the Fed funds rates at pretty much 100%. So the market is pricing it in and expecting a rate hike. So, okay, we'll give them a rate hike. And what about the future? And there's probably some grumblings in the room and talk about, well, we don't want to really do anything to really spook things and cause the dollar to move up much higher. We don't want to really have bonds selling off much more. So what we'll do is, instead of four rate hikes that we talked about last year, and even though we only did one, but four rate hikes really pushed the dollar higher in this discussion. Well, you know what? Let's back it off one. We're only going to talk about the potential for three rate hikes next year. And maybe they'll get the idea that we're a little less hawkish than we were last year. I don't know. I don't know how they come up with the number three. Last year they were going to do four. They only did one. So already they're three behind the ball in terms of the amount that they were going to do. And we have the potential for fiscal stimulus to be in there, assuming all goes well. So now they're going to only do three. Ah, okay, what's going on? Fine. Let's do three. Let's see how it plays out. Markets reacted rather anemically. There was a bit of a sell-off, about 100 and something points on the Dow after rising up for the week before and into that actual announcement. And then the S&P, the NASDAQ came in pretty good. The dollar spiked dramatically towards 103. So we're talking about a 6% move for the dollar in the last several months. And the last 2 months in particular, the biggest rise after the announcement that Donald Trump had won the election. So I still think that that's going to be a major headwind, as I've talked about several times with regard to many of the companies that do exports from the U.S. And I just don't think it's being priced in correctly. I think what's being priced in is the idea that, well, there may be some headwinds from that, but wow, we're going to get some major tax relief on a corporate and an individual basis, repatriation. So that's going to enhance some of the stock buybacks and dividends. And of course, some kind of either shovel ready or infrastructure spending. That's all being priced in, but not the fact that the dollar is so strong. So we'll see how that plays out when reality does in fact hit, dependent on exactly what they can pass through Congress and get into law in terms of the total overall tax benefits and relief. So it was a unanimous vote for the benchmark index to be raised an entire quarter of a point. So that was expected, I think, pretty much. But we did see the two-year note rise to a level that I think it was back in August 2009 was the last time it's been that high. Something we've been talking about. I mean, if I haven't talked about it once, I've talked about 100 times about how the potential for a sell-off in bonds was imminent and it could be pretty dramatic. And I talked about this probably about 4 months ago. As a matter of fact, I spent an entire show ranting and raving about how you need to shorten up the maturities on your bonds. I hope you did that. And how you need to really be in the lower duration if you're in mutual funds, or even if you had ETFs, if you had individual bonds, you need to shorten up those yields, shorten up those maturities, because there is a potential for this to get a little out of control, which it was. Don't forget, we were at historic lows on yields. Did anybody think it was going to last forever? I don't think so. We were hoping that it would keep going lower because things in the world were questionable and there was definitely some softness in areas around the world, ex-US. So I think the idea was that even if we are a lot stronger here, well, there's going to be a lot of money coming into the bonds of the US. If you didn't notice, by the way, Japan is now the number one holder of treasuries in terms of external, in terms of countries outside, not here in the US, not the Fed. I'm talking about of sovereigns holding of treasuries. Japan snuck ahead of China. And that makes sense. Their bonds are yielding nothing. They could sell off the yen and arbitrage it into the US treasuries and therefore make a nice interest rate at the same time, hopefully getting the benefit of an increasing value of the dollar over the yen. Now, another thing that's going on here is the concern about many of the bonds who are issued in dollars by foreign countries. A lot of dollar-denominated notes have been issued because a lot of players didn't want to buy bonds of the countries, name your country, in their own currency, concern that their central banks would continue to devalue and debase their currencies. So what they did was they issued them in U.S. dollars. Now, where's the problem with that? Well, as those countries eventually or currently need to repay back those bonds when they mature, they have to pay them in dollars. Now, as an example, if you're Japan and you did this, let's call it a year ago, well, the yen has dropped about 18% approximately from the high to the low against the dollar. Therefore, now you're using a much weaker yen to buy back or pay back those bonds in dollars. And that could be a big concern in terms of the availability of some countries, maybe not Japan, but other countries that have done the same thing, particularly in emerging markets, because now they have less money. The oil is valued lower, which is, and their natural resources for the most part are valued much lower. Their currency is lower and they have less of a budget to actually pay back these bonds. So there's some concern being, you hear some rumors and murmurs and rumblings and grumblings about this issue right now. Something to pay attention to. In terms of some of the economics that we saw last week, retail sales were up a little bit, just ever so slightly. We saw that the gain was 0.1, which was not better at all than what economists had expected and hoped for. It was up 0.2 minus car and truck sales. The producer price index, though, the wholesale inflation was up 0.4%. Now, annualized, that would be 4.8%, obviously. And if you look at it on a year-over-year basis, it's not that much. But if you do look at a chart, I did post that on Twitter, and you can follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz, my name, one word. That's my Twitter handle. I posted a chart right after this came up, and you can see that there has been a very a clear uptick of inflation on the wholesale side. Now, what's interesting about that is You wouldn't necessarily expect that. As the dollar has moved higher, you would think that, well, goods could be purchased from outside the country for much lower cost, and therefore in putting it into the manufacturing and production process should actually decrease the overall cost of the manufactured goods. That's just at the manufacturer level. And so therefore you should think that, hey, that makes sense. We should see a bit of a retracement lower for the PPI or wholesale inflation, but that didn't happen. We did see that the CPI, the actual inflation rate at the consumer level, advanced, it was up about 0.2% in November. Now, housing starts came in declining about 18.7% last month. And we have winter, we have weather. Okay, that's to be expected a bit. Single family starts were down about 4.5%. And there was also about a 4.5%, 4.7 to be exact, decline in November on building permits. Again, some of this is weather related. But we did see the Dow move up for the week. The S&P declined just marginally, 0.6%. The NASDAQ was also down 0.13%. And we did see that oil finished the week right at 52 and gold at 1135. Now, I tweeted also something about gold on Friday or Saturday that we started to nibble into some of the gold miners. If you look at the chart of gold, you look at the chart of gold miners, really they've been ransacked ever since the election. As the dollar has been moving higher, gold has been moving lower for a lot of different reasons, but we're starting to see that maybe there's some possibility of an oversold and basing action that's going on primarily with the gold miners. Now, you can look at an ETF, which is GDX. You can look at for a short-term trading position. I'm talking about days to weeks at the most. You can look at NUGT, which is the triple gold miners leveraged ETF. Again, you have to look at that for a shorter term trade and or at least trade in and out of it or around it. But gold is starting to, I think, maybe have a slight resurgence here after we're seeing all of the good news priced into markets for the time being. There's also some trouble, as I mentioned at the top of the show, that Trump is targeting China. Recently, there was a report that a unmanned drone, underwater drone of some sort from the Navy, from U.S. intelligence, wherever it was from, was picked up by a Chinese vessel and, as he said, they stole it. But they picked it up and the question is going to be, is there going to be more retaliation for these kind of actions, at least verbally, at least somehow for Trump to be commenting about this? He's already commented about how he's really concerned about trade policies with China and dumping rules with steel, et cetera, and trying to close off the doors for low-cost goods from other countries into the U.S. And on top of that, China has now turned around and said, well, the U.S. car manufacturers have a monopoly here and where you want to do something. So there's the underpinnings of a bit of a trade war, at least a verbal trade war, I guess we can call it a cold trade war that's going on with China. That's not going to be good. In addition to that, we've seen that this whole populist movement and the concern about hacking that's going on with Russia and the election and all the things that have been brought into the fore recently, I would think that there is the possibility, and I would watch this very carefully, put it on your watch list, that that gold could have a resurgence here. I'm not a gold bug, you know that. We've been out of it for some time. But I think that there's the possibility that there is some opportunity in gold. Just think about that. Let's talk about it real quickly before we get to our guest. And then we have also some listener questions that I'm going to answer. What do we have coming up? So this week we have Lennar is announcing the earnings results on Monday. Now, Lennar is a good company to be watching for what's going on in within the home builders and real estate sector of our economy, a very big and important sector from the aspect of the construction and employment, et cetera. Now, we saw last week that the home builders, their NAHB optimism poll, if you will, it spiked. They're excited. They're happy. They're looking forward to all the things that are happening in the future, especially post-election. So that's a good thing to see. We're going to also see CarMax, Darden restaurants. We're going to see what's happening with these restaurants. As I've mentioned, we're seeing some softness and weakness in many of the traditional restaurant chains. But as we talked about last week, some of the ones that have experiential type of opportunities like a Dave & Buster's is breaking out to, you know, incredible moves to the upside. But we have FedEx coming out, General Mills, Nike. Nike has been under pressure for some time. We'll see if there's going to be a change there. And if, in fact, some of this banter between the U.S. and China is going to hurt them. Then we have, coming on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we're going to see existing home sales and earnings from Bed Bath & Beyond. That's an important one to watch. They've been suffering at the hands of Amazon. Finish Line, another shoe company, or sneakers and tennis shoes. And we have Micron, Red Hat, and Winnebago, which has been on a tear. On Thursday, we get initial claims, consumer spending, durable goods, the PCE price index, which is important for inflation, and the last estimate of the quarter three GDP. So, and earnings from a company called Cintas, which is a supplier of, we'll call it, goods for businesses such as uniforms, et cetera. And then Friday, we're going to have new home sales figures and the final number of the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index for 2016. Coming into the end here, we'll see how this goes. We're going to see that probably starting next week, we're going to see turnover beginning for the, you know, with the idea that people are going to be rotating their portfolios from the winners to losers, losers to winners. And we're going to see how that's going to be playing out towards the end of the year. But right now, really doesn't seem like there's a lot of change in trend, even though last week was a little bit sloppy. We did see that even though there was that sloppiness, just right after that, they were bidding up the markets again, trying to see if they could rise that and maybe hopefully get that 20,000, that ding, 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 20,000 number for the end of the year for the Dow Jones Industrials. Really not the most important thing to get it to there, but it seems like there is that magnet. There's a desire to put on the hats and celebrate, and we are in that time of year that people are wearing hats and streamers are going and balloons are going off, and just why not have a big party towards the end of the year? That's the hope of the of many of the bulls out there, that we'll get to that 20,000, and then who knows from there. After we talk with our guest, I'm going to talk about some of these listener questions. By the way, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and what you can do is there's a little button there that says Ask Andrew on the right-hand side, and on the top it says Ask Andrew. Just simply go there, ask a question, and we'll get it read and discussed and maybe answered either by email or on an upcoming episode. So I want to thank you for all the ones that you sent in, and we'll answer some of those right after we finish up our discussion with our guest on in the area of college planning. Our guest today is Brad Baldridge, and he's host of the podcast Taming the High Cost of College, and he has a website with the same name, and Brad is a late-stage college planning specialist. We'll get into what that exactly means in a moment, and he basically helps some parents and high school students and people pay for college, and we're going to get into the whole discussion about college and costs and the runaway cost of all this and a variety of things. So, Brad, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Great for having me.
So, you know, we know that over the last number of years, there has been not only a rise, but a ridiculous rise in the cost of education. A lot of that is due to, you know, a whole host of things. But it's becoming a little bit more expensive each year and more difficult for people to pay for this, right? I mean, what are people doing?
Yeah, well, college is becoming a much bigger piece of the, I guess, financial budget for the typical parent. And that's essentially what they're doing. They're saving more, they're borrowing more, and they're spending more than what we did 10, 15, 20 years ago.
So, but the problem is now that you know, we hear these horror stories about people coming out of school with incredible amounts of debt, and you know, how is that, you know, how are we going to get beyond that?
Right. Well, I don't know that we are. I mean, the bottom line is, for most students, college education is worth it if you apply yourself, and ultimately you're going to earn enough that it makes sense. Now, the fact that it's going to take you 10, 15, 20 years to dig out of the debt that you create, I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's the reality of colleges raise their prices, we still come. Why wouldn't they raise their prices?
Right. Well, not only that, you also have the fact that the loans are easy to get to, and there's been a lot of promotion of the need. You know, the word in the street is, listen, if you don't have the college degree these days, you're not getting a job. So therefore, you're forced into getting a college degree, right? You got to start out with all that. But so with regard to the rising cost, do you see that that situation continuing with the amount of college tuition inflation that we've seen over the last number of years?
Yeah, I see it continuing, but not as fast, because that's kind of the hidden information out there, is the overall price of college, you know, especially like private colleges, has been going up at relatively high percentages, 7-8%. But the net cost has not been going up as fast. So a lot of colleges out there, and again, depending on their ability to attract students, a lot of them have raised their prices, but also raised their scholarships and other incentives in order to get the students to still come. So the net cost hasn't gone up nearly as fast as the overall cost. Now, so, if you're
but where are they getting the money for the scholarships? And why don't they just keep the price down?
It is a tuition discount, because if they, there's been surveys out there where families appreciate getting an expensive education and winning scholarships much more than having a lower cost. So it's just kind of like the jewelry store that's 50% off. It makes you feel better.
Right. Yeah. So even though the price may be, you know, whatever the price is, it's just, but you know what? We are getting a discount on it. So, wow, that's a great thing. So all right. So as we look at this, and as we see that there is this escalating pricing and this need for the diploma and maybe advanced degrees and things of that nature, we haven't even gotten into that expense, but what are the things that people are doing these days, smart parents? What things are you helping people do in order to plan in the future? So I don't know, when the kid's born or 5 years old, or maybe even a little bit later stage where maybe somebody hasn't done all the planning. What are you doing to actually get them set up properly?
Yeah. So I guess the first concept people need to understand is there's kind of two stages. There's the early stage and late stage. So early stage is when you have a baby, you're thinking about having a baby, or you've got a preschooler, that type of thing. And at that stage, if you think you're going to be contributing significantly towards college, you need to kind of bake that into your financial cake and say, all right, well, if we're going to be spending money on college, maybe we should be saving a couple hundred a month or $1,000 a month or whatever that right number is, depending on the number of kids and how much you think you might spend, and start saving and investing. Now, sometimes you save directly for college, and other times it just makes sense to just build your net worth so you have some flexibility. You know, if you had $100,000 in a pile of mutual funds and you chose to spend it on college, great. If you chose to not spend it on college, that's fine too. But if you have it, you have the choice. Whereas most families, you know, run their budgets really tight. And when they get to college, throwing an additional college cost on top of the budget, you know, it kind of breaks the camel's back, so to speak.
You know, I always had the best college planning program that is available is have the grandparents pay.
There you go.
But seriously, you know, you have the things and everything varies by state, you know, and you have some of these prepaid programs that were very popular for a period of time where, and I'll tell you, my kids had the prepaid program in Florida, and we paid, you know, next to nothing for it 20 something years ago. And now they go for 4 years of tuition free. Now, obviously, there's issues. Well, what if they don't want to go to an in-state school? And then there was some changes done to the plan and all that. So that's one place to do it, right? A prepaid program? Mm-hmm.
Yes. The prepaid programs are becoming less popular. Some of the states don't like it because the promises they made were pretty rich, and therefore it cost the state more than they had intended. So a lot of states have backed away from providing as much of the nice benefits. But then, of course, every state also sponsors a more of an investment style 529, where it's not a prepaid tuition. It's just in a form of investment where you can, you know, save for college and get some tax benefits.
You know what this reminds me of? And I think it is exactly the same. Many years ago, companies would offer defined benefit pension plans. Well, you would go and you'd work there for a number of years and you do your time. You didn't have to participate in it. And when you retired, you get a guaranteed income for life, or something of that nature.
Correct.
And then you have a situation where companies said, well, that got too expensive, because you look at what happens. We're on the hook as they live out their lifetime for all this money. And, you know, maybe there's inflation adjustments involved in it. And it got very expensive for them to do so, to set aside all the money. So they said, you know what? I have an idea. let's come up with a defined contribution plan of some sort. And it kind of evolved into a 401k where a company may help you along, but what you do is you participate by putting all the money in yourself, and then you have whatever you have at the end. It's the same thing. Whereas the states for college no longer want to be on the hook for the longer term money. They say, you know what, we'll provide a plan for you. You put the money in and then you take care of it. And we'll provide some benefits along the way for it, like tax 529, tax deferral, and tax-free withdrawals on right. it at the end. So it's kind of almost the same. Well, not exactly the same, but similar to, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's becoming now where you didn't have to plan and understand what was going on. The company was going to take care of you, and shifted to now it's the worker's responsibility. And it's the same thing with college. It's getting expensive enough now that good planning can make a huge difference. But that's just one more thing that people have to spend their time and energy on, is understanding what's available in my state and should I participate, and all the other pieces of the college planning puzzle that in the past we just kind of ignored and waited until little Johnny or little Susie was
off to school,
a junior, and you say, okay, now we got to figure this out.
College is coming now.
Right.
So a lot of the things that you help people with, let's talk about some of the things that maybe people don't know about, where there may be some money up for grabs that if they did a little work or maybe hired somebody to help them with this, there are a lot of different grants, scholarships, and things that are available to individuals, right? That are not so obvious sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a big myth out there where there's, hundreds or millions of scholarships going unclaimed, and that's just patently untrue. But what there is out there is there's some that are, not applied for. I was at a high school the other day, and I asked the counselor if there's anything during a presentation, if there's anything that was kind of underutilized, and they said, oh yeah, we have a scholarship for the football players and the POM squad. And we had 4 applicants for 4 awards. And it's like, oh, well, guess what? That's probably because there's 100 people in that room. It's probably not going to be that way anymore. Most of the football players are going to get off the dime now and participate. But had you been involved in that and kind of spent the time to find it, great. Now, would have that gone unclaimed? Probably not. The counselors probably would have walked up and down the hallways, grabbed the football players, and says, apply to this. We've only got 2 applicants. I'm sure you're going to win. So it's not going to go unclaimed, most likely. But again, understanding that there's various things you can do around scholarships. There's various things you can do around saving and investing. There's things you can do around tax planning. So there's a lot of areas above and beyond just filling out the FAFSA and seeing how it goes.
And what are most people doing these days? Are they, maybe that's a bad question. Probably there is no such thing as what most people are doing, but are the costs for the most part being shifted to the student? Or is it, I guess that would happen if there was no planning done, right? So you get to be a junior and you're like, okay, what do we do? Well, it's going to cost you $25,000 a year for school. And the parents are like, where do I get that from? And say, well, let's just get a loan. Now, there's some discussion. What is the story with regard to these loans? So you get a loan and you get a student loan, and these are special loans. It's not like a regular loan. If you go bankrupt, you still have to pay it back.
Correct. Right. So there's this catch 22 where in order to make student loans available, they had to put the caveat on there that you cannot discharge them in bankruptcy. Otherwise, they would want to underwrite the student, right? If I'm going to give this student a loan and as soon as they graduate, they file bankruptcy and we're out, who's going to, who would lend that money? So then they put the caveat on there that said, well, you cannot discharge it, which made it a little easier for it to be available to students and parents where they don't have to go in such strict underwriting. So it's a double-edged sword. It allows loans to be at, better interest rates and make them available to people that don't have a credit history or a poor credit history. But the flip side of it is you can't get out from under them either. So
because it's now an appendage.
Yes, exactly.
It's stapled to you.
Exactly. It follows you around. And there's some extreme circumstances. And the federal loans, as an example, through death and disability and other very extreme circumstances, they will be forgiven. But in general, just the idea that, well, I just got in over my head and now I'm going to file bankruptcy is not going to work.
Now, what about how I've heard recently that there is the potential that if a student defaults on the loan, that it could flow back to the parents?
That is possible, especially, again, depending, there's a number of different types of loans. But There's some student loans that are student only. There's some loans out there that are parent only, and then some student loans that are parent and student together. So depending on what type of loan you're pursuing and signing up for, you really need to understand the fine print.
And obviously, I think this is a very key point, because we're talking about something that is not dischargeable through bankruptcy or anything else. And if you don't pay for it, they get pissed off pretty quickly.
That's correct. And
I've seen this in action on a friend's son, by the way. It got ugly very quickly.
Right. And they, just like any other collections, it's not fun to be on the receiving end of a collections situation. And I think really what it boils down to is that I think people are getting wiser now, but through the recession, there was kind of a shift of, well, any college at any price is worth it. Just go ahead and sign up for whatever loans you can. And there's a number of students that took on a lot of loans, had trouble finding work during the recession, and realized that they're in way over their head. And people have heard the stories now, so they're a little more cautious in general. I mean, not everybody, obviously, but there is a right amount of debt for your family. What that is, up to you. But I think the challenge that most families run into is at decision time, when your son or daughter is looking at you and saying, well, I want to go to this school instead of that school, but this school, is $10,000 a year more or $20,000 a year more. And you don't really understand the whole process. It's pretty easy for you to kind of cave to the pressure. And, again, parents want what's best, and you probably agree that school is the best choice.
Yeah, but, I hear you. It's a very complicated area, especially when it comes to these loans. But now we have this loan forgiveness. Now, are you in favor of this loan forgiveness program that's being bantered about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it certainly is it's a safety valve for a lot of families. I would much rather see people go out, be successful, and pay off their loans as agreed. But it's nice to have that safety valve for someone that, due to no fault of their own, especially, if you have people that become disabled or other reasons that they just cannot participate in the workforce as much as they would have liked to, or other extenuating circumstances, it's nice to have that safety valve.
Now, what about these for-profit colleges? There's been a lot of talk. There's a range of what these are, right? There's some of the bad actors and bad players in this area. And we know about some of these companies. They either went out of business or they really, for a while there, they were under severe pressure. Trump gets elected and all of a sudden these things are flying and going crazy on the upside because the idea that, a for-profit college is not going to have as much scrutiny. I don't know why that necessarily is the case. So maybe because of his Trump University, I suppose, maybe. But right. What's the story with these for-profit colleges? How do you know if they're good or bad?
Yeah. And again, I don't think they're good or bad. They're good or bad for a particular type of student. Unfortunately, a lot of these colleges are preying on people that have a tough time getting accepted or otherwise pursuing education through the typical channels. And whether it's non-traditional students that are going to go to school nights and weekends, or it's people that have a tough, tough academic history so far and aren't really that qualified. So the population they're serving is in that situation where they're going to struggle and a lot of them aren't going to make it. Now, the challenge, of course, is, well, if 1 in 100 could make it, does that mean we should say no to these people? Why, if you want to try, go ahead is one mentality, right? Even though you're likely to fail, we really shouldn't close the door on these people. Mm-hmm. So we give them a shot. And then when it doesn't work out, we've got a mess. And, so that's part of the politics of, well, who do we, just like when they, said everybody should be able to buy a home. Well, you can say that, but then when you gets in practice, then we've got people that can't afford a home buying homes.
Right. And that's exactly kind of what happened here. Everybody should have a college education. Everybody needs to have a college education. Everybody has to have a college education, even if you have to beg, borrow, and steal for it. And what's happening is we're seeing the same kind of debt issue compound right now in that area. But let's kind of go backwards for a second and let's talk about some useful things that people can do. Like, let's say, as you mentioned, early stage. So 529s, prepaid plans, or just saving on a regular basis, which is kind of hard for people, but I got to tell you something, even $100 a month or $150 a month, once you start doing it for a few months and just start automatically investing is a good idea, right?
Absolutely. Or maxing your 401k. Just so that you know, let's say you match, they match up to 6%, but you can go up to 22%. So you do that. And then when you get closer to college, you go from 22% down to 6%, but you've got a big lump sum in your 401k. So your retirement looks pretty good now. And the fact that you're going to back off for 4 or 5 years while the kids are in college still, you know, still allows you to retire on time.
But how do you take, but where's the money now? You're saying the differential, you can't use the 401k, can you?
Well, no, you wouldn't necessarily use the 401k, but the differential again.
Ah, gotcha.
Where you're used to saving, you know, an extra $1,000 or $1,500 a month, more than the typical family, and all of a sudden you say, well, I'm going to redirect $1,000 a month or $1,500 a month towards college, that can put a pretty big dent in your college plan.
Right. And then, but that's the beginning stage. So that really it's just, it's methodical and continual savings. Even if you get a full ride scholarship, okay, so you have that extra money there, right? So you can use a variety, exactly, of these, plans to do so. And then let's kind of get into the next stage. You kind of start panicking. Your kid is now getting into junior high school.
Right. And absolutely.
You have, no money saved.
Right. Now we switch into what we would call late stage planning. The reality of it is, especially if you look at middle income and up, kids are going to go to college. Parents are going to bend over backwards to make it happen somehow. It's not, again, for a lot of families, it's how, not if. It's how are we going to make this affordable and how are we going to do it the right way instead of the wrong way so that we don't regret our decisions. And that's where we get into late stage planning. You know, late stage planning is now where you need to start figuring out, am I going to qualify for need-based aid? Am I going to qualify for merit aid? Should I be looking at state schools or private schools? How many schools should we visit? How do we choose a major? You know, what's all this testing we have to figure out? How do we apply? Should we be going to elite college? I mean, there's just a gazillion different decisions to be made. Mm-hmm. Most families start this somewhere late in their junior year right now, which has kind of been the norm. And I think it really needs to be done late sophomore, early junior year now, because you just need more time to do it well.
Yeah. There's definitely not an easy path. Let's be honest. I mean, you can hire people and stuff. And obviously, you know, even when we're looking at the whole idea of bringing people in, the fact is that there's still a lot of moving parts to the whole process because, you know, in-state, out-of-state, like you said, what's your major? What schools do I apply for? And not to mention the work that has to be done for essays, application process, all the other things, and visits. I mean, it's a very time-consuming process, you know.
Absolutely.
It's not like just going to your neighborhood school anymore down the block.
Right, exactly. And now there's another way to think about it, too, is there's things that parents can do by themselves to prepare for college, and there's things that students can do, and there's things that parents and students will do together, like visits and things like that. But, you know, sometimes parents say, well, my student doesn't know what they want, and they're too young, and they're not mature enough. And that's fine. That happens a lot when you've got a sophomore. You're not really ready to visit colleges and that kind of stuff. You're still dealing with high school. But you might be ready to start figuring out, as a family, are going to qualify for aid? As a family, should we be saving and investing more or less? As a family, if we did that 401k strategy where we were, you know, way overfunding our 401k, is now the time to back off and start moving that money into something college focused? All those types of things can be done whether or not your student is ready or not. I think it's a huge learning curve, kind of like if you were going to do your own taxes or other areas where you got to kind of learn how the system works.
Yeah. And it's not easy. Definitely not easy going through it myself for three.
Exactly. And if you're going to hire someone to help, kind of the same situation where give them the time to help you. I mean, to walk in when somebody, you know, middle of your senior year or even middle of your junior year and say, hey, we're stuck. Now what do we do? Yeah. I'm here. Help me. It's like, I generally can't help those people.
Yeah, I hear you.
But in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, man, I wish you would have been here a year ago.
Yeah.
Because I could have helped you more.
Yeah, I hear you. Brad Baldridge here, TamingTheHighCostOfCollege.com. His podcast talks all about this, various strategies, various information. We wanted to kind of go a little bit off the beaten path of what we usually talk about on the show, because this is something, obviously, that's, you know, very important. It's very important to start planning this to make sure that you have all your ducks in a row well before. So this is your wake-up call. If anybody's listening out there that has not started planning and, you know, maybe you're into the, let's just say, you know, seventh grade,
maybe it's time to start thinking about, what are the opportunities that and what are the things I should be doing here? So I'll make sure that the links to your site, podcast, and all that are on the show notes for this episode. I want to appreciate you coming on board today.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Now, what you've been waiting for, I know, aside from the information that we got from Brad on college education, again, changing up a little bit here, is some questions that came in from listeners. I know everybody enjoys that, so I'm going to kind of try to hit some of these. First one we have from, let's see what we got here, Dave Adams. He says, hey, Andrew, I enjoy your podcast as well as DH Unplugged for several years. That's good. Thanks so much for listening to both. Of course, just as a point of reference, I'm saying this, not Dave now. If you're not listening to DH Unplugged, you need to do so. DH Unplugged is a great podcast with a lot of information. Myself and John T. Dvorak each and every week, dhunplugged.com. All right, back to the question. I also listen to others, and it's more of a hobby, and I mostly listen while I get my 30 miles per week runs in. 30 miles per week, so if he does it, let's see, 5 days, it's 6 miles a day. Very impressive. I heard you speak about something in a new investment strategy, and I think you were offering, is this the TOA? Oh, I see what you're asking here. He wants to know about, we talked about Investology and a new offering we're having, which is it's very similar to our global allocations, with the exception that much lower minimums for entry, and also it's, as we call it, advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced portfolio construction and management. So basically what you have is all the best of the world of us looking at your portfolio, managing your portfolio, and you know those robo-advisors out there, they offer these ETFs and they're trying to do so at no cost, a low cost, but you have to pay the external, the management fees for the ETFs, but you only get ETFs and there's a whole world of other investments out there in terms of packaged investments of mutual funds. And we believe, if you've been listening to me for a while now, that you have the opportunity to get some great investments from active managers that are appropriate in certain areas. For example, outside of the efficient markets of the US, I don't want to be in an ETF for the most part. There's some great managers that we've lined up with incredible long-term track records. Investology is what we're calling it. It's not available right now, but if you are interested, you want to sign up for at least the announcement of when it comes out, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, scroll down a little bit. There's an area that says Investology. It tells you a bit about it. And then there's a little form there that you can just put your name and email in so that when it does, in fact, when we release it finally, a lot of construction of the back end because you're going to get access to your accounts right there and portfolio performance and charts and graphs, really cool stuff that's going to be available to you on the back end when you're a client of Investology. But go over there, and at least for right now, everybody, and I'm telling you this also, Dave, you can go look at some of the things that are happening with Investology, which is our new platform that we're releasing. All right, this next question comes from, LP, Peter H., Peter Hollett. When a wealthy individual recommends to invest in real estate analogous to precious metals, does that mean to buy physical real estate or REITs? If virtual, that means that you could have a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds, real estate and precious metals, all inside of one broker. Although that doesn't feel diversified enough for major collapses. Okay. Where do I begin with this? So I don't know who you're speaking to and I don't know what they're talking about, but yes, I think that real estate itself is a good diversifier. It has been for years, just like commodities and bonds are traditionally against what we have seen with regard to equities. Now, in 2007, 2008, 2009, everything seemed to move in tandem because everybody was just getting out of everything. Now, it was predicated on the real estate collapse. We know that. But when you look at the overall markets and how they performed long-term historically, real estate in one category, cash in another category, fixed income in another category, equities, and that's a big universe of equities, domestic, international, in another category, real estate in another category, and then finally commodities. Those are the best diversifiers. So when they're talking about this, it could be REITs, clearly, but REITs are going to act like bonds and stocks at the same time, potentially, and they have lower volume and less liquidity. So therefore, REITs may be problematic.
What you could do is have some real estate outside. Maybe they're privately traded. Maybe it is direct land ownership. Maybe it's your home they're talking about also. So whether it's wealthy individuals or not, I think it is appropriate to have real estate in your portfolio. For many of us, we could say that we do have real estate in our portfolio, even though we don't have it directly invested inside of our brokerage. We have it through our home. Now, on one hand, I always say, well, you do not want to have your home as your area that you say, well, that's an investment. And, you know, you stay up at night, what's happening with it? And I bought it for an investment. You buy it to live in. It is part of an investment just by the very nature of it. So I think that real estate does, in fact, hopefully that answers that question. This next question comes from Chris Stanley. Nope, that's not right. Chris Staley. I've been reading lately that there is a possible scenario for a global dollar shortage illiquidity. Can you explain this? I'm assuming that that would be deflationary. Could this affect or tie into bond market problems you seem to have mentioned on your show lately? By the way, long-time listener, love the show. I look forward to it every Sunday. Hey, thanks for listening, Chris. I appreciate it. Make sure to tell your friends. You know, this is a good question because I don't think there's necessarily a shortage of dollars, but the demand is much higher. What we're seeing is that there's a shortage of other currencies and people fleeing towards the dollar. Just look what happened in India recently. Look what's happening with the talk about doing away with some of the higher denominated bills in Europe. People are freaking out about that and like, well, I don't want to be a part of this. You know what? I'm dumping my euro. I'm dumping the rupee and I'm going to go buy into dollars. So I don't think there's necessarily a shortage of dollars, but there may be a liquidity issue, a little bit different, because everybody's pounding into them, driving the dollar higher. So what happens is while you have liquidity with the dollar, it is the most traded currency out there. And again, depending on how you trade it against other currencies or a basket through the Dixie, usually when we quote the value of the dollar, it's in terms of a basket against other currencies. So when you look at this and you look at the actual dollar, I don't think that is necessarily a lack of or shortage issue. It is becoming liquidity. That is why some of the dollar value is going higher. Is it deflationary? Yeah, it should be deflationary, of course. It should lead to the fact that inflationary for countries outside the U.S. because the dollar could buy a lot more of their product much cheaper, and therefore what happens is that becomes inflationary, but deflationary here in the U.S. All right, let's see. This next one is from Hashim Jumai. And Hashim writes, hi, Andrew. How do you interpret the latest OPEC decision? Do you think that the agreement will hold? And will all participants play by the rules? Thanks a ton. Well, you're welcome a ton. do I think that OPEC, that question, I think, is a good question. And I think I've talked about it so many times. Actually, I've tweeted about this on Twitter a lot. It's kind of one of my pet peeves. OPEC doesn't stay by what they say they're going to do. They say something just to drive the price of oil up, and then they do whatever they want. Even though the non-OPEC last week came in with saying, yeah, we're going to cut also, and another couple of countries, and I think it was Qatar last week, said, yeah, we're going to cut also. I think this is all a staged process to drive prices higher to increase profitability for OPEC. We already saw that some of the shenanigans that they're pulling with regard to how they're going to cut. And it's really more like a freeze. It's not really a cut. And the freeze is on the highest levels they've been pumping recently. So they talk about a cut, but it's really a freeze. And they're probably not going to stick to that anyway. I don't trust them. Now, does that mean that oil's going down in price? No, that I'm not saying that either. What I'm saying is I just don't trust them. And almost you have to look at it as semi-comedic, the way that they operate. And finally, we have a question from Netko. I'm going to butcher this. Histrov. With markets at record highs, he asks, Cape at peak levels, inflation ramping up, and commodity in a slump, do you see a reversal in, say, the next 6 to 12 months as the Fed increases rates? What do you see bond prices and gold moving? Where do you see bond prices and gold moving? Okay. And he sent me some charts. He looked at various ratios. The Cape ratio is basically a normalized PE ratio. I think I've also posted some charts on this. Normalized PE ratios with regard to a 10-year average PE ratio. And whether you look at that or you look at forward PE, I think I posted that last week, where you see that the forward PE is about 17, 18. You see the trailing PE on the S&P 500 is about 26 or so. And the KPS is at pretty significant high levels at this point. Right now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, and I've talked about on here and on DH Unplugged, I talked about on Twitter, what's happening now is that everybody is just juiced up over the opportunities and pricing in every possible good thing and ignoring any bad. That's fine. And what's also happening is that everybody's starting to hop on board. Everybody's like, ah, you know what? Things are going higher. We're getting closer to that 20,000. And look at the S&P. Look at the NASDAQ. Look at the small caps. Boy, I don't want to miss out on any more of that. And with all of this going on in the background, with the dollar rising as well, that there is some optimism that has been created, and there's been, as a lot of people call it, animal spirits. And what is animal spirits, by the way? You've heard this a lot, animal spirits. So animal spirits are active. Well, animal spirits are simply, as I see it at least, the most basic instinct that people have, and that's a bit of survival and aggression. And what that means is that we're seeing that people are buying without any thought. Animal spirits. We're not saying, well, they're really buying on intellectual spirits. They're buying on animal spirits, or animal spirits have been awakened. I think if we say that intellectual spirits have been awakened, that people would realize, just as you're mentioning here, that, hey, wait, there's a problem here. Ratios are really out of whack, and there's going to be a lot of disappointment. Don't forget also, one of the things that I think everybody is forgetting here, it's very simple. Even if every single thing is enacted that looks like it's good news for markets, taxes, repatriation, dollar moving higher that could be beneficial somehow to, or trade policies being ripped up or redone, benefiting the U.S., how long is that going to take to actually trickle into the value and the bottom line of stocks? You know, if you have tax reform that goes into place, let's say next year, it's going to take a year, the following year. If you have trade deals, it's going to trickle in very slowly and average out in possibly 2 years from now. So a lot of the things that are being talked about are being bought up well in advance of not only it being implemented, but also seeing the realization of how it's going to benefit companies. And as I mentioned earlier, Nedco, that I think that gold does have an opportunity right now to move with many of the things that we're seeing and the uncertainty, because I think there is a, you know, the first thing that happened was the horror. I'm just saying it from a market standpoint, not mine. The horror that, oh, wow, Donald Trump was really elected. Markets took a major nosedive overnight, recovered with, wait a minute, but think about this. Well, we got both Republicans in the White House and in Congress, so laws will be passed much easier. They're talking about repealing Obamacare. They're talking about lowering taxes. Look at all these things that they're talking about. This could be really good. So what's happened is that they talked it up, and now everybody's leaning on that side of the trade. They blew out everything else. And as we've seen in the past, well, you know, markets have short memories. Maybe what's going to happen next is maybe not a downstroke necessarily that's going to be catastrophic, but maybe a reversion to the mean on some of these areas that have really gotten overdone, whether that's stocks, whether that's bonds, and whether that's gold, precious metals, commodities, emerging markets, et cetera, so, and the dollar. So I think there's a good point that you make there, and I think that it's nothing to panic about necessarily, because there still is these quote-unquote animal spirits that are alive and well right now. But eventually, intellectual spirits will be awakened as well. I think I'm going to write a blog post on that. We'll see. I'm going to write something about that maybe for the next quarterly Horowitz & Company commentary, or I don't know, update it somewhere. Anyway, thanks for that question. And of course, I mentioned that you can ask me a question if you like as well. Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, probably the third time I've mentioned that. And you can find out, by the way, about all the different strategies. I mentioned Investology, but also Arrow. You can get some information about what's going on with our algorithmic strategy, which has been the last four or five trades been spot on, whether it's short, long, or neutral. And you can find out about the TDIMG managed growth strategy. If you're looking to diversify your portfolio a bit, that's an important place to look, as well as our global allocations. And of course, all of our trading indicators that are available for TradeStation, something you need to check out. Well, with that, let's see. Let me think about this for a second. Next week. Yeah, we're going to have a show next week. Of course, we're going to have a show next week. But it's going to be right on. It looks like it's going to be on Christmas Day. So we'll have some joy and maybe just, it's going to be Hanukkah too. But if you want to get in touch with us, just contact us. It's also on the Disciplined Investor and all the other areas that you can check out. DH Unplugged each week, and you should listen there with John T. Dvorak. And other than that, I think it's a wrap. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.